Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
In a world where confusion often reigns...
I'm sorry, I'm confused.
...there rise up wise men. Men who can bring answers to many challenging, even perplexing Bible questions.
Was Jesus able to look up at Mary there in the manger and, yo mama, you know?
Brad, you're predestined to answer this.
I am.
Is there anything wrong with being baptized twice?
That's a really good question.
What can you say, really?
So my question is he still fully God and fully man after his ascension into heaven?
And everything that's said about Jesus is that he is truly God and he is truly human. And I'm going to go with that he still is.
Don't try to unscrew the unscrutable.
That's right.
No. Now from Studio D of the Faith Radio HQ, it's Connecting Faiths. Ask the Professor.
Here we are on the Faith Radio.
With our noble educators from the Verdant Campus of University of Northwestern St. Paul.
Fine professors you have there today.
And now a man almost as wise as the professors.
Inconceivable!
Neil Stavem.
Oh, poor Neil. The big buildup, and then he's not even here. Well, I'm Joe Rathmanner. I'm in for Neil today, and we have our monthly installment of Ask the Professor. It's, of course, one of my favorite shows to listen to, and now I get to be here asking the questions and listening right here in the studio. We would love to have you call in. If you have a question you have been dying to know about the Bible, about faith, about God, about philosophy, we'd love for you to call in today. The number is 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. If you are a little on the shy side, would rather write out your question, we'll take that too. Go to myfaithradio.com, click on the show, Connecting Faith, and you can type your question in that way. I would love to introduce my guests for today. You may know them. You may want to get to know them. With me today are Dr. Brad Sickler. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at University of Northwestern, St. Paul. And I know that he's a favorite of the students here on campus. And so very, very excited to have him on the show today. And then Dr. Ed Glennie. He's the Professor of New Testament Studies and Greek. And I can tell you he's a favorite of students as well, because I was one of his. So I adore him, and I know you will too. Both are scholars in their field and beloved professors here at Northwestern. So welcome, Dr. Glennie. Welcome, Dr. Sickler.
Thanks, Joe.
Good to be here.
And we will refer to them as Ed and Brad for the rest of the show. So if you have a question for Ed or Brad, please give us a call, 1-877-93-FAITH. Now, I know that just in the last several months, you've been on sabbatical, Ed, and that for people who don't know what that is what?
Sabbatical is like Sabbath. It's a seventh year, a time of rest for professors. It's supposed to be anyhow. And at Northwestern, the program is that after you've taught six years, you can apply for a sabbatical on your seventh year that you would use as a time of professional improvement or study and refreshment and kind of rejuvenation also to give you a change of pace so you're ready to come back on your eighth year and start over again.
So as a New Testament scholar, you said you were working quite a bit over your sabbatical on the Septuagint. Can you tell us what that is and why it's important?
Yeah, I'm primarily a New Testament professor here at Northwestern, but in a second doctor's degree that I did at the University of Minnesota, I was involved in studying the Septuagint for my dissertation. The Septuagint is the Greek Old Testament, and you may remember that the Jews went into captivity and were dispersed from the land of Israel about 400 or 500 years before the time of Christ. And many of them, well, they went to different lands, and many of them went to the land of Egypt. And it was in the land of Egypt primarily where, as people lived in these other lands, could not speak the Hebrew language, they needed their Old Testament if they were going to remain Jews in a language they could use. So they translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek. and that is what we call the Septuagint. There are various legends about how it took place, that it was 72 people, and so therefore it's called the 70 or the Septuagint.
And so why is it important to study that?
Well, it's important for a couple reasons for us. Maybe first of all, it's important for Old Testament studies because there are questions in some passages occasionally about the text of the Old Testament. And the Septuagint isn't exactly the same as the Hebrew. It has different readings, some which are very interesting. One is, of course, that we're very familiar with, Isaiah 7:14, the virgin will conceive and bring forth a son, whereas the Hebrew has a young woman. The readings in the Septuagint sometimes are, we are more convinced now than ever before, better readings actually than the Hebrew text. And what's really made that clear is the findings at Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, many of which readings agree with their old readings, some of them perhaps the oldest we have of the Hebrew text that agree with the readings in the Septuagint rather than the Hebrew text that is in our Hebrew Bibles that are used today, the Masoretic text.
Awesome. Very interesting. If you have a follow-up question on the Septuagint or why we study that, why that's important.
I should add one other thing about why it's important for us as Christians, especially, and that is because it is the Bible that was used by the early church. Their only Bible was what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, but it was used primarily as Christianity spread around the Mediterranean world and the Roman Empire, the then known world. It was propagated primarily by the use of the Septuagint. And as many as 80% of the Old Testament quotations in our Bibles, in our New Testament, are in agreement with the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint. So it was very important for the early church and the Bible that was, we could call the Bible of the early church.
Were some of the translations that we have today, did they come directly from that?
The translations of what?
The translation into English. Did it come directly from the Septuagint? Or did it go into a couple other languages first?
Well, there is a translation of the Septuagint that is available today called the New English Translation of the Septuagint. But as far as our New Testaments today come from New Testament manuscripts, Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, that have been translated into English. And so when we talk about these quotations, we're talking about the quotations, the text that would have been quoted by the authors of the New Testament or Paul, what they would have used and written in their manuscripts. And then we translate from their manuscripts into our Bibles.
All right. Well, great to get to know you and what you've studied, at least in the I know you've studied it for a long time, but pretty intensely over the last year. And we're going to get to know Dr. Sickler as well. Brad, you just had a breakout chapel on Monday, which is like a extended session describing some of your recent work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I only have one doctorate, but and I have no intentions of getting another one. But I studied physics as an undergrad, my bachelor's degrees in physics. And when I was a physics student, I wasn't terribly good at the math. I could do it. It was tolerable. But I was really interested. I look now in retrospect and I understand this. I was really interested in some of the philosophical issues that get raised, especially in modern physics. For example, things like quantum mechanical tunneling. In a case of tunneling, which we all make use of in a lot of our electronic devices, there are these little things called tunneling diodes. And they depend on this phenomenon. And in tunneling, for example, you'll have an electron, and it doesn't have enough energy to clear a barrier. But sometimes it clears it anyway. And this is sort of like if, I can just barely jump high enough to touch the rim of a basketball net. And I do that, and I'm able to do that. But every once in a while, I jump all the way through the roof and over the house. I mean, that's the sort of thing that ends up happening. And there's no, causally speaking, it's we can't understand it. We just have to acknowledge that this takes place. And there are other sorts of things like that happen. I still will go to the bookstore with my kids and go in the kids section, you know, there's a lot of times those little trains set up mm-hmm. on the train track, and you can take the trains and they have
sometimes
magnets.
Sometimes kids steal the trains that are on the train tracks before.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. Yeah, and that's in violation of the Decalogue.
Yes, it but is.
the trains have these little magnets on the end, and I just still think it's fascinating that you can put one of the trains near the other one, and if the magnets are opposite in polarity, it'll push it away without touching, and it just blows my mind. Or, you know, you just, these are the things that I guess I'm pretty easily amused, but you can take a pen and just drop it, and why is it falling? You know, why doesn't it just float there? What's happening? I don't see any strings. There's no connections to pull that thing down, and all these causal relationships at their deepest, most fundamental level are just really weird. And as G.K. Chesterton put it, one of C.S. Lewis's favorite authors, they're nothing but weird regularities. And this got me interested. And then as I went to seminary, I studied more about causation and got interested in the cosmological argument, which is an argument for the existence of God based on the existence of stuff, based on the existence of the cosmos. There's no particular reason why there should be anything rather than nothing. But there is, and so we can wonder about how that came about. And one of the premises in a cosmological argument is that nothing happens without a cause. So I spent some time thinking about that claim and what it even means to be a cause, and got exposed to some philosophers and theologians who had thought about these sorts of things. And then went on in my PhD program to maintain an interest in causation, because I started to see that it was really central to lots of other things that I was interested in, like, you know, the cosmological argument or the design argument for God's existence.
A lot of why questions.
Talk about miracles. David Hume, a famous skeptical Scottish philosopher, argued against the possibility of miracles, and that has a lot to do with his views on causation. And so I just saw that over and over and over, as you peel back the layers on some of these important questions, you really get causation, laws of nature, causal relationships, causal necessity. You get all those things underneath. And so it's something I'm still interested in, and still thinking about things like laws of nature and what a law of nature is and how it relates event types and what it would mean to be a type of event. And when we talk about causes, what is it that's being related? Obviously, causes and effects. But what is a cause and what is an effect? And some people might say, boy, this is really stupid stuff. I just can't believe anybody thinks about this. Ridiculous. But to some of us, this is just really great stuff.
And there's
stuff.
Obviously a connection between what you're studying with causation and faith, or something about faith that has led you to be teaching these particular subjects here at Northwestern. So what is the crossover there?
Well, part of it is my growing view or understanding of or appreciation of God's absolute sovereignty moment by moment. You know, sometimes we operate with this view in mind that once upon a time, however long ago, God kind of said kablooey, and then there was all this stuff, and every once in a while he sticks his finger in and mucks with things a bit and performs a miracle, you know, pulls somebody out of a lion's den or something like that, helps somebody walk on water. But really, that's a really watery view of God's causal relationship with the world. And it doesn't come anywhere near capturing the biblical picture that moment by moment, all things are sustained by God and held together in Christ. And just what that looks like to have a really robust view of causation, where God is the ground of all of these relationships and is the one that sustains them and brings them about. So my interest is, you know, kind of crossing the theological and the philosophical and the scientific to help us really have an adequately robust view of how God as creator relates to his creation.
All right. Is there anything that we've said that has kind of spurred an interest in your mind, something that you're curious about? Maybe you're interested in causation or God's sovereignty or different parts of the Bible that you have questions on as well. Give us a call and we will get them on the air. We're going to take a quick break, but give us a call at 877-933-2484. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith.
Beth Moore once noted, "One day it dawned on me, no wonder we are so exhausted. We are waiting on everything except him." Good point. It was a process of time and seeking that I'm now at the place where I think I get to read the Bible and not I have to. I made myself accountable to go to God first by not going to my email or Facebook until I had spent time in the Bible, which gave me this little jingle. First to God we must look before we connect on Facebook. Think how often we wait for a text, an email, or a phone call for encouragement or how to know what to do. Now look at Isaiah 40:31. Those who wait for the Lord and expect, look for, and hope in Him shall change and renew their strength and power. Are you hearing this? You can be changed just by waiting, expecting, and hoping in Jesus while at the same time renewing your strength and power. What Facebook friend can do that? Wait on anything else and you'll always be thirsty, but wait on Him and you'll be filled every day. For more encouragement, visit DebbieGriffith.com.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. My name is Joe Rathmanner, and I'm in the studio today with Dr. Brad Sickler and Dr. Ed Glennie, and it's Ask the Professor Day, which means you get a chance to give us a call and let us know what questions do you have, maybe about the Bible, maybe about God, His sovereignty. The lines are open. You can give us a call, and we will try to get your question on the air. We have one right now from Dan. Dan is calling in from Hugo. Dan, do you have a question for the professors?
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. These questions come up in conversation over and over again, so I'm just trying to get the professor's perspective. So the first question is, can you, the New Testament professor, can you help us reconcile the God from the Old Testament to the New Testament and provide some help with that? And then the second question is, oftentimes what I'm hearing now is the response that the universe has always existed. And that's the answer to the question of how does something come from nothing? So how do you answer the response of the universe has always existed? That doesn't make sense to me. And then the other question is just, can we get some insight about reconciling the God from the Old Testament to the New Testament?
Well, let's start with that second question. And I think I'm going to ask Brad, we'll defer that to Brad. How has the universe always existed?
Oh, wait, you can't start with the second question. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that is a good question, Dan. Thanks for calling. So here's the deal. Our empirical evidence, our ability to observe these things is very limited. So as far as just looking out and seeing whether, you know, how old the universe is, we're very limited. And we certainly couldn't see what there was before this universe began. So let's say you accept all the premises of modern cosmology, and you think that the universe is about 15 billion years old, and you think that it popped into existence out of some teeny tiny thing called a singularity, smaller than a dot on a page of one of your books. Well, there's no way for us to penetrate any further back than that. Now, there are some models. You know, we can talk about an inflaton field that gives rise. It's a sort of universe-generating mechanism. Or you can take an oscillation model that the universe, you know, will contract again and then explode again, and that it was an explosion from a previous contraction. But first of all, that's the important thing to note, is that empirically speaking, in terms of our observation, our ability to actually test these hypotheses, we're just hopeless. We just can't. So there are different mathematical models, scientific models, and they'll try to say, well, this model implies the possibility of that. But that's very, very weak tea indeed. I mean, we just can't prove any such thing. So people will speculate and say, well, the universe has just always existed. I guess I have two things to say in response to that. I mean, these are kind of philosophical. I guess I can't help it, but, one of them is, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense to talk about the universe having always existed. And here's one reason why. If the universe has literally always existed, then there is an infinite sequence of events in the past that would have to make up an infinite collection of stuff, right? So you take a moment ago and add to that a moment before that and add a moment before that and so on. And eventually what you would have is you would have accrued an actually infinite collection of moments in the past leading up to the present. But I'm not sure that makes any sense. I mean, we normally say, no, you can't have an infinite collection of stuff. If If I say, oh, I collect seashells, and you say, how many do you have? And I say, I have infinitely many. You would know that I didn't mean it, right? That's impossible. I can't have infinitely many seashells. I'm not sure you can have infinitely many of anything. And a succession of moments in the past would be just such an infinite collection. And I think that's problematic. But the other point is that even if the universe were infinitely old, it wouldn't mean that it didn't still require a cause. And I know we're getting pretty deep in the weeds here, but I still think, and partly this is a result of the reflection of causation that I've done over the years, I still think that even if the universe were to be infinitely old, it would still need a cause for its existence and its being sustained in existence. And you can read Leibniz or Samuel Clarke on these kinds of questions. They thought that before it was in vogue to think the universe had a beginning. But, you know, cosmologists generally think it had a beginning. Beyond that, you know, we're empirically at a loss to go any deeper.
Okay. That answers one of Dan's questions, and it looks like we have a few minutes left before our break, so let's get to Dan's second question, and this is for you, Dr. Glennie. Can you help reconcile the God of the Old Testament with the God of the New Testament? They must seem different.
It's a good question, Dan, and you're right. It's one that's often discussed and brought up in casual conversation, especially with people probably who are not perhaps real well acquainted with the Bible, or those who perhaps think they are, and I think perhaps misunderstand it. Let me read what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. He's involved in a discussion of food sacrificed to idols, and he says in verse 4, "So then about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one." So Paul says there is one God. "Or even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods," in maybe quotation marks, many things called gods, "and many lords," many that are called lords, "yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came." Notice it's "from whom all things came," "and for whom we live. And there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live." So it's very interesting here in the development of the New Testament that Paul says there is one God, but this one God exists in two persons. He exists in the person of God the Father, and from whom all things came, and in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Christ, through whom all things came, through whom God worked and mediated himself to this world. I think one of the biggest, so I hope those verses might be, excuse me, helpful to you to try and get perhaps a little bit of Paul's perspective on that. I think one of the other things that is often mentioned when people start talking about perhaps how do we reconcile these gods is that the God of the Old Testament is a God of wrath and anger, and the God of the New Testament is a God of love. But I think that's really oversimplifying and missing a lot of what the Bible says. For example, when God describes himself in Exodus 34 to Moses, who wants to know who he is, if he's going to lead the people of Israel, and Moses is to be his mediator to the people, it says God passed in front of Moses proclaiming, "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin." And then it goes on to say he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. So he's a just God, but he's characterized here as a God of love. And on the other hand, when you get to the New Testament, the topic that Jesus spoke about more than any other, if you look at his teachings, perhaps aside from the topic of money, was the topic of hell and judgment to come. And Jesus warned over and over about that. So I think I would just try to answer those two things. Number one, I don't think the Bible passages teach that, where it lays out the doctrine of God. It teaches there is one God. And secondly, I think to try and place part of, you know, make the God of the Old Testament a God of wrath and anger and the God of the New Testament a God of love misses the whole picture of the Bible.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Glennie. And I hope that answered your question. We're going to try to get in one more before our break here. It says, what about the people? Will has called in from White Bear Lake and said, what about the people who live in a culture where they didn't have the opportunity to hear about Jesus Christ? Will they get that chance before they die to accept or reject the Lord? And I'll just throw that out to either of you.
Well, I'll start with a passage, perhaps for Will, that is the one that I depend upon, I guess, to answer this passage. And it's in Romans chapter 1. And I'm going to begin in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, where it says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen.
Okay, Will, or Ed, we're going to let Will kind of think about that as we take our break, and we're going to have you answer that right after the break. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us over your lunch hour. Today is Ask the Professor, and in studio today I have the pleasure of having Dr. Brad Sickler, an Associate Professor of Philosophy at University of Northwestern, and also Dr. Ed Glennie. I'm stuttering already. Ed Glennie, who is Professor of New Testament Studies and Greek, and we've been having a great conversation here and answering some of your questions. And I had to cut Ed off there just at the bottom of the hour when we were trying to answer Will's question about what happens to the people who live in a culture where they did not have the opportunity to hear about Jesus Christ. Will they get that chance before they die to accept or reject the Lord? And Ed, you were on Romans 1:18.
Yeah, let me pick those verses up again, Will. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them. I think that's really important. What may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse, is Paul's answer to that, I believe, in Romans chapter 1. So Paul seems to be saying here that he's referring to the revelation of God in creation, in nature, and he's saying that there are things about God that are revealed in nature. It talks about his eternal power, his divine nature, the fact that there is a God, a creator God, should be seen by those who are willing to see it in nature and creation around them. And Paul's logic seems to be here when he says they are without excuse, that such a revelation should lead people to seek this God and to attempt to find him. And I might just add, and I can't prove this from the Bible, but I've heard stories, and perhaps you have too, Will, and maybe others have, of people in cultures that are pagan cultures where there is no one teaching the gospel to them, of being convinced of the existence of God in nature and calling out to this God and finding him by God bringing someone across their paths, or by something that God brings into their lives that reveals himself to them. And I think there are other verses in the Bible that talk about it. If you seek me with all your heart, you will find me, and so on. And I think that's part of the logic of what Paul is saying here also in Romans chapter 1, that the revelation of God in nature should lead us to seek after this God. And I believe in God's goodness, if someone does that, that God will make it possible for them to find him. I might also just point you to Psalm 19, which talks about the revelation of God in nature also.
All right. Thank you. And Dr. Brett, Dr. Sickler, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Yeah. Another passage in Romans that's relevant here. And I think everything that Ed said is right on. The reason that we ask this question in the first place is because it seems like it would be unfair of God to judge people for not responding to the gospel if they haven't heard it. But part of what that passage that Ed read sets up is that, look, we are all in this situation of open and willing rebellion against the Creator. And it doesn't matter, you know, Jew or Greek, living in under special revelation through Scripture or not, we're all in the same position, and we do it because we are sinful and rebellious. So God is supremely fair in judging whomever He will, whether they've had an opportunity to hear the gospel or not. But in Romans 10, Paul says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. This is in starting in verse 13. And then he takes up this question specifically. He says, how then will they call on him in whom they've not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. So he's saying someone has to come and preach the gospel. That's why the feet of those who bring the gospel are so beautiful, because they're bringing something needful, necessary for salvation. And then he continues to go on to say in verse 17, so faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed, they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So more of this universal revelation that Ed is talking about. So I think, you know, another, it's a balm to some people's conscience to say, well, if they would have been the kind of people who would have responded, then they would have heard the gospel. Mm-hmm. And that's another way to think about things too. You know, if they would have been inclined to respond, God would have guaranteed. And that's a position that some people, or a claim that some people will add to help make sense out of that. But I think that Paul's pretty clear here that it's necessary to hear and respond in order to be saved.
That's really good, Brad. And that last verse you read, their voice has gone out into all the earth and their words to the end of the world, is Psalm 19:4, the passage that we just referred to. Maybe we could just, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. So, yeah, I love that. And it really ties it right back in with this revelation of God in nature, Paul referring to it there in verse 18. That's great.
And it's part of his message as he preaches, too, when you read what he says to pagan audiences as he travels around in Acts, for example. You know, he talks to the Athenians in the Areopagus, and he talks about how God has been, you know, determining the boundaries that they live in. And starting in verse 26, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us. And so again, you know, this, to me, because I see it everywhere, I guess, goes back to some of the stuff I was saying about causation, and how even these things, you know, where a nation is and its boundaries and when it's there, the allotted periods, all these things are part of God's divine governance.
Okay. Well, hope we answered your question there. Thanks so much for calling in. If you have a question for Brad or Ed, give us a call, 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484, or feel free to log on to myfaithradio.com. You can enter your question that way by email, and we will read it on the air. We have a couple of questions here on Revelation, so I'm guessing I'm deferring to Ed here. The question is, what is your view on the seven churches? Are they seven ages of the church, or are they simply seven churches in the first and second centuries?
That's an interesting question. I'm teaching the book of Revelation this fall, and we're just about to go through those. We're just finishing our introductory material. And I argue, and I'm convinced that the best way to understand them is that they are seven churches, that the seven churches that existed in Asia Minor. at the time that John was given this revelation from God, and he gives it to the churches. I think they are perhaps, we might say, representative of churches of all ages. In other words, you can find things in these messages to the churches that will apply to your church today, I am sure. But the problem with seeing them as churches through the ages, a view that has been held at different times, and I think that in the age of the Reformers, those kinds of readings of Revelation were very popular, and they had it all worked out what they thought was the, you know, what the churches represented. But then people who take that view today have to change it around and make it different, and it doesn't work anymore because we've gone 400 or 500 years since the time of the Reformers. So I think it's very subjective, and it says at the beginning of the book of Revelation, Revelation 1:4, John to the seven churches in the province of Asia. And then it actually names these churches down in verse 11 again. I think it's verse 11. Write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Maybe if I could be so bold, I might just say that Dr. Musk and I are leading a tour this spring, March 6th through 17th, to these the area of these seven churches through University of Northwestern. And we're convinced that these messages were written to those churches, and we're trying to understand the background of them to better understand the messages and what the book of Revelation is all about. And if you're interested in perhaps going with us on that tour and understanding better the book of Revelation, I would invite you to contact me here at Northwestern, and we'll certainly give you information on that.
All right, Diane, there's an invitation. Ask a question and you get more than you bargained for. Diane had a follow-up question. She said, I'd like to know if you can recommend any good books that unpack the end time events. I know that's a big question. I used to ask Dr. Glennie, hey, are there any books that maybe you could recommend? And then I'd buy like seven. So be prepared.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll tell you a couple that I like, and they're more connected with the book of Revelation. The commentary we use in the class as our textbook is the NIV application commentary by Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R. And I think it's a good commentary on the book of Revelation. It gives you some different views sometimes. I mean, it gives you not just one view, but it will give you more than one view on some things. But I like him because I'm a premillennialist, and I think he comes down in the end being a premillennialist and reading the book of Revelation that way, although I think reading it very fairly and understanding the historical background as well as the future. The best book that I could recommend to you, the one that I continually recommend to students, it's not an easy book, but if you really want to get into the book of Revelation, it's called The Theology of Revelation by Richard Baucom, B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, Richard Baucom, and it's a paperback, maybe 200 pages or less, put out by Cambridge University Press, and it is a bit academic, but it's not anything that probably any listener to this program couldn't read and get a lot from and understand, and it's not real long. And I think it's one of the most one of the best treatments of the theology of the book of Revelation that is available. So I'm giving you more books on the book of Revelation, understanding it. I know than the last times. I don't know if Brad has a book on the last times that he likes, but those are the ones that I use primarily on the book of Revelation.
All right, Diane, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to get to your questions and more in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break, but we would love to field your questions here on Ask the Professor, 877-933-2484 or myfaithradio.com. I'm Joe Rathbanner in for Neil today. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
What are you willing to do to go beyond the call? This is Wayne Peterson, president of HCJB Global.
While exploring the South Pole, Sir Ernest Shackleton was forced to leave some of his men behind on Elephant Island. His return was promised, weather permitting. Day after day, the rescue grew more impossible until finally the fog lifted. An opening in the ice was spotted, and the stranded men were saved. Once safely on the recovery ship, a reporter asked the group leader about the men's readiness. Flashing a smile, he said, "Every morning I told the crew, roll up your sea bags, boys. The boss may come back today." In Luke 12:40, Jesus warns us, "Be ready, for you don't know the hour of my return." Always be prepared to assist in whatever situation God throws your way. Go beyond the call. And then visit us online at hcjb.org.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Saint, thanks so much for joining us today. I was just kind of lost in that music right there, kind of listening to that song. Very nice. Mm-hmm. We have Larry calling in from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and he has a question for our professors. Larry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There's a verse in the Bible that says two people be out in the field, one will be taken, one be left. I mean, there's other verses that relate to it. Is that the rapture or not?
That's a good question. Also, Larry, I wish I could find that verse exactly to look at the context of it a little bit, and I'm not able to pull it up off the top of my head. Is Larry still with us? Does he have the verse?
Larry, do you have the verse?
No, I don't have the verse. I apologize for that. But, you know, my sister thinks that it's the rapture, but I heard it's different. I heard that's not the rapture.
It's hard for me to, I can't just off the top of my head pull the verse up either. Maybe it's the kind of a thing.
Is that late in Matthew when he's talking about?
Oh, Matthew 24 or 25.
Yeah, 24.
24, 45. Okay. We're getting there, Larry. Thanks for your patience with us.
Oh, thank you.
Matthew 24.
24:40.
Yeah, Matthew 24:40. The point of the parables, I can say this as I start to look at it for just a moment, at the end of Matthew 24 is the unexpectedness of the Lord's, unpredictability of the Lord's return. It could come before you expect it or after you expect it, but as you can see in verses 36 and following, it's basically at a time when that is unknown. And it says let's read verse 36. No one knows about the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know at what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at the time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch, and so on. If you believe in a rapture, this is the rapture, I believe. I mean, I think people who understand there is a rapture in Scripture where some will be taken would apply that to it. And I think that would be the main distinction. I mean, I think people who don't see a rapture, see one coming of the Lord at the end of the age, are going to see it more as that one coming, just the Lord coming at the final, when the Lord returns. It makes sense in the rapture passage because of the idea of one being taken and one being left.
Yeah, I think that's probably what prompted Tim LaHaye and the Left Behind title as that kind of description. And to expand a little bit on what you were saying, Ed, in case people aren't aware, some people will think that Jesus will just come once to judge and establish his kingdom. and other people think that he will come, but not establish his kingdom at that point, but to steal away, which is what the word rapture means, right? The stealing away of the church. And then generally there will be a period of tribulation or something following that, and then Christ will come again. So whether there will be one such event or two, and how you understand not only this passage but lots of other passages throughout the Old and New Testament will partly guide where you land on that.
Maybe this would be a good point to introduce that word you just said a few minutes ago, premillennialism. See, I can't even say Ed Glennie. I can't even say premillennialism. There we go. Maybe this would be a good time to explain that, explain a couple of those terms, because that kind of fits into this whole conversation that we're having.
It does. Yes, it does, Joe. Premillennialism is the idea that the Lord will come before the millennium and he will establish the millennium here on this earth. A literal, usually understood to be a literal, about 1,000-year reign. Some people don't say it has to be exactly 1,000 years, but there's this number mentioned, I think, 6 times in Revelation 20, 1,000 years. And that could be figurative, some might say, but generally it's understood to be a literal 1,000 years, that Christ comes before it and establishes it, and then he reigns on this earth for 1,000 years. And that would be in distinction from post-millennialism, which would basically be would see the millennium perhaps even as something that comes to pass in this age as things get better and better, and we enter into a millennium, and then Christ would come at the end of that millennium. And the third view, which is probably premillennialism and amillennialism, are the two main views today. Amillennialism means no millennium. But that's a little misleading, because the idea is there is a millennium, but it actually began with the Christ events, with the resurrection of Christ, so to speak. And Christ is reigning today, either over the church or over believers in heaven who have gone to be with him in heaven. And the millennium is not a literal millennium upon this earth. It is a spiritual reign of Christ. And for an amillennialist who believes Christ is reigning today, I don't believe I know of any amillennialists who believe in a rapture. They believe Christ will come and there will be one coming. Whereas premillennialists, many of them, if not most of them, would believe in a rapture, although not all. And there would be, but a dispensational premillennialist normally believes someone who's takes a dispensational view of Scripture, that there are these various dispensations or ages leading up to the millennium and then the final kingdom, eternal kingdom. They would see a rapture normally that would take place at the end of this age, as Brad mentioned, catching believers out of this world to be with the Lord for a period of time, either 7 years, 3.5 years, a short period of time before then Christ would come back and he would establish that millennium at the end of that period of 7-year tribulation. I hope that hasn't been too confusing.
Well, it's a big subject.
It is.
That is a big, it's a big term. It's a big subject. I'm going to practice saying it 15 times in a row now so I can say it fluidly. All right. We have a question from Marie. Marie has a question on the New Testament. She says, does it say anywhere in the New Testament that women are not allowed to preach? That's the Jeopardy. No. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
I didn't know if that was the end of our time or what. Well, I can jump into this. We can spend the rest of our time on this one, I guess.
Yep, you have a few minutes.
Let's start with what it says that a woman. I don't know that it definitely. It doesn't have a statement that states what Marie mentioned anywhere in the New Testament. It does say 1 Corinthians 11:5, for example, that every woman who prays or prophesies with their head uncovered dishonors her head. If a woman does not cover her head, she should, and well, it goes on. We don't need to go into that, I guess. But it does talk about in 1 Corinthians 11 about a public assembly, And I think it's implied in the verses I read in the passage that a woman can pray or prophesy in church. I don't think I'm going to try and get into what prophesying involved, what I think it involved in the early church, but I think it would be somewhat like getting up and expressing something the Lord has laid on your heart. And it happens in our churches today. It's almost like giving a testimony. And it says that a woman may do that. She may pray or she may prophesy in church. The verse that I think is crucial, I'll just go there, and I don't know any other way around it. I personally have questions about a woman being ordained, is how I would say it, or being the head pastor in a church. I have been a member of a church where a woman is children's pastor or music pastor and so on. And again, there's great difference of opinion on this. Marie, is that right?
Mm-hmm,
this
Marie.
Is Marie. This is my, I'll give you my reading on it. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11, it says, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. Paul says, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. And then he gives a reason why. The reason why has nothing to do with the culture in Ephesus, where Timothy was, that Paul was writing to. It says, for Adam was formed first, then Eve. There was an order of creation. And Adam was to have authority over Eve, apparently, in their home being created first. And seems to be saying that that same arrangement also is to be brought to bear, is to also exist in the church. And he gives a theological reason for it there. And so therefore, the way I read what Paul is saying there, and I think it's consistent with what I read in the rest of his teaching, it teaches, as I understand it, that a woman is not to be teaching with authority over a congregation that involves men. Doesn't mean she can't be involved in praying or prophesying or teaching women or teaching children and doing all kinds of other things, but that's my read of 1 Timothy 2:12. Maybe Brad wants to follow up on that. Maybe he doesn't.
Well, that is the classic place to look for this, because that's where it seems to be the clearest, and that's the passage that everyone wants to look at and try to understand rightly. And I think one important thing is something that you just pointed out is, you know, a lot of times in response to this, we'll say, well, this was just cultural in this. You know, Paul says, I do not allow it. That doesn't mean it should never be allowed. But that's what makes this passage so interesting, is that he ties it to actually God's created order in the first place, and establishing Adam first and then Eve. But just to note, you know, we often do the same thing with our culture and say, well, our culture must, you know, we should conform things to our culture. So sometimes we dismiss things too easily because we say, well, that was just their culture. And actually, you can pretty much wriggle off of anything that's unpopular today by doing that.
That's a good point.
But we're just as likely to skew things because of our previous commitments to propagating our own culture, too.
That's
but
right.
This is, you know, to be fair, these are tough questions, and there are smart, godly people who land on both sides.
Exactly right. Yeah, I agree with you on that. And Marie, I'm giving you my read on it. And
Marie, thanks for calling in. We appreciate your call. We appreciate the comments from both the professors. And let me just end on this by saying, if you feel encouraged to preach or teach, I ask you to please investigate that with your own prayer life in God. That's this connect.